Scott Hewart is a professor of chemistry at Cal State University Fullerton. His research is focused on atmospheric, combustion, archaeological, and green chemistry. He has directed the environmental chemistry program at CSUF for many years. Please join me in welcoming Scott Hewart. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for inviting me here today to talk about environmental sustainability. There were two major turning points in my life that led me to focus on environmental sustainability. I was raised in the suburbs of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I grew up two blocks away from a waste incinerator. I can always remember my mother screaming for me to come outside and help her get the laundry off the clothesline as the ash was falling from the sky. I thought that was normal. I remember going to parades with my dad in downtown Milwaukee and seeing the Milwaukee River with all this foam in it and all these different colors in the water. I thought that's just how things were. During my doctoral work at Columbia University, a friend convinced me to go on a multi-day hike in the High Peaks region of the Adirondacks. It was absolutely a beautiful area. The forests, the mountains, the water, just a beautiful trip. It was exhilarating to be out in nature and hiking. Until you got to the top of the peaks, all the trees were dead. And this was my first experience with real environmental degradation. And this was due to acid rain, which was a problem in the Northeast. I was shocked enough by this that I decided to switch my area of focus to atmospheric chemistry, and I ended up focusing on smog. I also came to Cal State Fullerton in part to develop an environmental chemistry program. Now I'll fast forward to 1996. I had an accounting student in my environmental pollution and solutions class. It's a three-part course. You can take the first part, the second part, the third part, or any combination of them. She liked the first part so much that she stayed on and took the second and third part. She even told me she would have changed her major if it wasn't for the fact that she was just 1 year away from graduating. The next year, she contacted me. She wanted to have a webinar presented to some of the Cal State Fullerton students. And the webinar was on global climate change and architecture. She thought this was really important for the students to see. I was the ever-skeptical scientist at that point in terms of global climate change, but I was willing to help her. The webinar featured three speakers. The first was the top global climate change scientist in the United States. There was an architect and one other speaker that I don't remember. The webinar made it very clear that we had little time to waste and that our buildings were a large part of our problem due to the energy usage from cooling and heating the buildings. The webinar really blew me away, completely changed my perspective. As a scientist, I was taught to be a dispassionate, critical thinker, but now I realize there was something more important for me to do, something that I was emotional about. The webinar ended about 9:50 p.m. Instead of going home, I spent maybe 45 minutes writing this long email to President Gordon, who was the president of Cal State Fullerton at the time, telling him about how we needed to reduce our carbon footprint. I focused on global climate change at first, but eventually, actually fairly rapidly, it kind of morphed into sustainability overall. So I was looking at all natural resources, not just our fossil fuel usage and agriculture, which tend to emit greenhouse gases. And in particular, I focused on green chemistry since I was a chemist. And on a sidelight, this accounting student, she ended up getting a job for the Cal State University system and ended up being a director for sustainability. So I thought it was very, very nice that I had an impact on her, but she also had a huge impact on me. I want to talk a little bit about sustainability. It's sort of a nebulous term. It means different things to different people. Part of that is because it encompasses almost everything. The standard definition of sustainability is meeting the needs of the present without compromising future generations from being able to meet their own needs. Often we think of it as having three different areas, a social, an environmental, and an economic. And if those are all in harmony, if we're working on all of those together, then we think of ourselves as being more sustainable, as opposed to if we focus on just one area and then the other areas suffer. Another way of thinking about sustainability is it's what leads to healthy people. So in order to have healthy people, we need a healthy environment, we need healthy communities, we need healthy businesses. Really, sustainability is about all the choices we make and the ramifications of those choices, both the environmental ramifications, the social ramifications, and the economic ramifications. Now, I started my career really in environmental science, and it's kind of moved towards environmental sustainability. To me, environmental science is about studying the way things are right now and trying to fix the problems that we have. Where sustainability focuses more on preventing problems from happening in the first place. So I hope this gives you a little better idea of sustainability. Next, I want to talk about some environmental issues. First, air quality, which is the area that I focused on for a number of years. You can talk about primary emissions to the atmosphere and secondary emissions. So first I'll talk about primary emissions. These are the mainly emissions from our cars, trucks, planes, trains, ships. So the areas that feel these the most are areas around ports, airports, industries, freeways. And most of these emissions are coming from the burning of fossil fuels. In our area, LA is the worst. Long Beach is second. Some of these emissions are volatile organic compounds, which are part of the unburned fuel that is emitted. And I'll talk more about that in a few minutes. One of the students I had in my green chemistry class a year ago, she was missing some class periods. And it turned out that she was being hospitalized because she was having severe asthma attacks. Her family lives near one of the freeways in the LA area. And her doctor had said, well, the only thing you can do is you really need to move. She doesn't have a lot of money. She can't afford to be on her own. Her parents don't have a lot of money. They can't afford to move either. So one of the problems with environmental problems is not just the environmental aspect of it, but it's the social aspect of it, that it's often the poorer people that are impacted the most by our environmental problems. Next, I'll talk a little bit about secondary emissions. So the primary emissions, the chemicals go into the atmosphere, the molecules go into the atmosphere, and reactions occur, and now new molecules are formed. Those are the secondary emissions. Now, because those reactions take time and our prevailing winds are an onshore flow, areas like San Bernardino, Riverside have worse smog problems than we do. So farther east you go. Now, to form smog, you need the volatile organic compounds, and you also need sunlight. We have a lot of both of those in Southern California. Now, since our atmosphere contains oxygen, we call our atmosphere an oxidizing atmosphere, in that oxygen reacts with the molecules in the atmosphere and adds on to those molecules. The partially oxidized volatile organic compounds that are produced as these secondary emissions, they're more toxic. they're more likely to dissolve in water, and they're more likely to stick together to form particles. And this is important because this is nature's way of cleaning the atmosphere. And it does it in several ways. One is the oxidized compounds are more likely to absorb sunlight and break apart. Second, the oxidized compounds are more likely to dissolve in water. So when rain happens, then the secondary emissions that are dissolved in the rain now is removed from the atmosphere and goes down to the Earth's surface. Lastly, the secondary emissions that now the molecules that stick together as particles, when those particles get big enough, they drop out of the atmosphere due to gravity. Okay, and due to their weight. However, smog, the ozone, the oxidized volatile organic compounds, the particles, they're not good for us. They're not good for our health. Frankly, we live in a bad place when it comes to smog. We really live in a box. I know we don't think of it that way, but it really is a box. We have, west is this way, right? Yeah, so we have the onshore flow coming this way. We are surrounded pretty much by mountains. Okay? We have the earth underneath us. And often we have temperature inversions above us. So a temperature inversion just means you have cold air down below, warmer air above. And we know that cold air won't rise when there's warm air above it. So what that means is that the pollutants are stuck in this small box, and they can't disperse from that box. So in most areas of the world, the pollutants can disperse. So you don't have really bad smog problems, even if you have a fair amount of primary emissions into the atmosphere. Okay, but that's not true of the South Coast Basin. Really, we shouldn't even be burning fossil fuel in the South Coast Basin because of the box that we live in. In addition, our urban sprawl is not helping things. To get almost anywhere, you have to drive a car. Now, hopefully, we will continue to reduce our emissions. In 1976, we violated the federal ozone standards on 194 days out of 365. So that means more than half of the year we violated the standards. In 2012, we violated that same standard only 12 days. So we've come a long ways. However, since then, the federal ozone standards have been modified. The standards have been lowered because it's been determined that in order to protect our health, we need to reduce our emissions even more. So in 2012, we actually violated the stricter 2008 federal standard on 116 days. So although we have come a long ways, we still have a long ways to go. Now, how have we gotten here? We've done many, many different things. We have catalytic converters on our cars. We have cleaner burning fuel, smog checks, carpool lanes. When you use a gas pump, there's a snorkel on it to suck up the vapors from the gasoline, so you don't really smell the gasoline the way you used to. Okay, sometimes if you go to another state and you fill up at the pump and it's like, whoa, you can really smell all that gasoline, because you don't smell that much in California. Our consumer goods have fewer volatile organic compounds in them, paint, lighter fluids. Okay. So many, many, many things have been done in order to reduce our emissions. And to be honest, it's truly amazing that over the course of many years, the population in Southern California has gone up dramatically. The number of cars per family has gone up significantly. The size of homes has gone up significantly. The number of businesses has gone up. And yet we've still been able to reduce our emissions. Now, many of the actions that have already been taken and that still need to be taken in terms of reducing our emissions further are kind of interesting in that they also lead to reductions in greenhouse gas emissions as well. So not only does it improve air quality, but it improves the global climate as well. And this is because many of the things we need to do revolve around reducing our fossil fuel usage. Next, I want to talk about our natural resources other than air, specifically ones that we're beginning to run low on. Some we've run out of, or we may run out of in the near future. One is clean drinking water. One out of seven people on our planet have no access to clean drinking water. What really amazes me is that we use drinking water to flush our toilets. We use drinking water to water our lawns. So what a waste. We're expected to run out of petroleum sometime this century. As a chemist, it seems a waste to me that we even use petroleum as a fuel, because there's so many other consumer goods of higher value that we could use petroleum for. Our clothes, fabric, plastics, almost all of our pharmaceuticals come from petroleum. Matter of fact, most of our chemicals and most of the chemistry revolves around petroleum. So it all starts with petroleum. The only other viable source of hydrocarbons on our planet is biomass. The problem with biomass is it's already been partially oxidized, and thus the chemistry to actually use it is very different from the chemistry to use petroleum. And as chemists, we're not quite there yet in terms of how to use biomass. Our high-grade copper and iron ore deposits in the United States are all used up. About five, 10 years ago, there were reports in the news about people stealing the wires from streetlights. Okay. They were doing that because they were trying to get the copper wire, because since we had run out of our high-grade deposits of copper, the price of copper had gone up dramatically. Another resource that maybe have 30, 40 years of left is phosphorus. Phosphorus is one of the key components of fertilizer. One thing that we probably ought to do is go back to the old-fashioned way. I know it kind of sounds yucky, but we used to use human excrement as fertilizer. Okay? We waste all of that fertilizer potential, right, when we flush all of our waste down the toilet. Platinum group metals, those are our most important catalysts. So those are used on things like catalytic converters for all of our vehicles. We're running low on those. Also on indium and our rare earth metals, which are used in all of our electronic devices. Currently, the only source of those are China. Okay, we don't mine them anymore in the United States. Now, we've lost these natural resources for a number of reasons. Okay, there used to be few of us on this planet, and our natural resources seem boundless. But now that there's 7 billion people on the planet, that's no longer true. We also have tended to think of ourselves as being separate from nature. However, we are totally reliant on nature. We need fresh water. We need clean air. We need nutritious food. We also tend to think that the purchase price of a product reflects the cost of making that product. Okay, but that's not true. That's not the way our economic system is set up. The loss of natural resources, the degradation of the environment, and sometimes what's done to our human resources, those are not taken into account in the price of a lot of our products. And that's why some of our products are so cheap. Lastly, as humans, we tend to be reductionist thinkers. We tend to reduce a situation to one or two variables in order to make it understandable for ourselves. But in doing so, we often miss the bigger picture and we miss the connections between things. The loss of our natural resources is also partly due to consumerism and planned obsolescence. If everyone on our planet acted the way we act, then it would take 3 to 5 planets in order to have enough resources for all of us. And given that China is becoming more and more like us, and India will soon too become like us, this is quite scary because those are the two most populous countries in the world. And you can't blame them for wanting to be more developed, to be more like us. But there just aren't enough resources on the planet. Our consumer goods are made to quickly break down, so we will buy more. Or the styles are changed by companies so that we will buy more. This is good for the short term, but it's not good for the long term. It leads to a loss of resources, more pollution. And on a personal note, a number of years I had sort of revelation. I realized that my family had bought a lot of stuff that, you know, we really didn't need. It was nice, but we didn't need. And we were regularly making donations in kind, but we were accumulating more and more stuff. And I realized we were just wasting our money. We were wasting our money both on purchasing things and then on maintaining those things. It made our house more difficult to clean up. It took a lot more time to clean up. I felt my house started feeling smaller and smaller as it filled up. The things we consumed ended up running us and consuming us. It became very clear to me that I am more happy with less, as I have downsized since then. And hopefully this will allow me to retire a lot earlier and that I'm not buying so much stuff so I can save my money. And I've also realized that you know, happiness really comes from your relationships, having work that is personally fulfilling to you, and having great experiences. Okay? It's not about the stuff that we buy. Okay, I want to switch gears a little and talk about green chemistry. Green chemistry is sort of chemistry or sustainability for chemists and for companies. There are 12 green chemistry principles. I've distilled them down to 6. One is prevent waste rather than clean it up. Second, be more efficient with the materials you use. Third, use safer chemicals and chemical processes. Four, design for energy efficiency. 5, use renewable feedstocks rather than depleting non-renewable resources. 6, design for degradation. So let me explain the last one, design for degradation. If it would be better to make a product such that when it degrades at the end of its life, whether that's in somebody's backyard or in a landfill, that it doesn't produce toxic materials as it degrades. So that's an example of designing for degradation. Now, businesses have come a long ways in terms of their attitudes towards the environment. It used to be that many companies couldn't afford to consider environmental issues, or so they thought. Now many companies realize that they cannot afford to not consider environmental issues. Companies have saved millions of dollars by being more sustainable and following green chemistry principles. For instance, Dow Chemical Company, they've saved $24 billion just by improving energy efficiency since 1990. General Motors, 70% of their facilities have reached zero waste. So they save money both because they don't have to pay to have waste removed, but also because they're reusing those materials. And so since they already have them, they're not buying more raw materials. Okay. So there's actually packaging material in our vehicles. Companies have also attracted new customers that are more focused on purchasing green products and services. Greener companies also receive lower interest rate loans, and their stocks have outperformed those of non-green companies in recent years. And lastly, while the number of jobs has gone down during the recession, the number of green jobs has gone up. I want to say a few words about what's happening in Orange County in California. There's really a lot. I can only mention a few things given the time. One is I want to talk about Rent-A-Green-Box. So this is a company in Huntington Beach. They've made plastic moving boxes out of recycled materials. And I just thought this was really cool because the input material is cheap and they only need to get more raw materials when they want to expand their business. And they have essentially no waste because whereas a moving company will just throw the boxes away or they give the boxes to you and then you throw them away, you return the plastic boxes to them and they will use them with the next customer. And after, let's say, about 20 uses, once they begin to start to show a little signs of wear, they just melt them down and make them into a new box again and start all over. So from a business perspective, they have very little expenses in terms of having to remove waste. They have very little expense in terms of raw materials they need to start with. So they're going to be more profitable because of that. There's a whole group of professionals in Orange County called CleanTech OC that are focused on greener solutions for our fuels, our water, and many of our products. There's also a U.S. Green Building Council that has an Orange County chapter. It's in Tustin. They can help you with how to green your home. California has a green chemistry initiative. And the idea there is to figure out what are the toxic products that are in our consumer goods and then come up with alternative chemicals that could be used that are safer and then give that information to the companies that are making these products for us. Now, to take sustainability and green chemistry one step further, we need to design to be better rather than designing to be less bad. We want to design to make the world a better place. This is what is called upcycling by William McDonough and Michael Braungart in their book, The Upcycle. For example, if you have a product that at the end of its life, it could be composted and would become fertilizer, that would be a lot better than a product that at the end of its life produces toxic compounds or just doesn't produce it, you know, is neutral. So it's all about design, and it's just a different way of thinking than we have often thought in the past. You've got to think all the way from the raw materials to the first use of a product to the second use and the next use and the next use. And we need to model what we do after what nature does, okay? Because nature has no waste. Okay? In nature, one species' waste is another species' nutrition. Now, what can you do? There's individual actions, community actions, institutional actions. First, I'll talk about individual actions. Many of these you're probably aware of. Right? You can educate yourself. Look for the connections between things. Reduce, reuse, recycle. Specifically, reducing energy usage, especially in terms of your home, and transportation, or use renewable energy sources, reduce water usage, reduce waste, live more simply. And I'm not saying that you have to give up all your possessions and all your interests. Do what's comfortable for you. So for instance, I have a truck, gets 18 miles per gallon, but I don't drive it very often. I walk as much as I can. I walked here today. I walked to work. I'm not sure if I've ever put more than 5,000 miles on my truck in 1 year. There are times I go a week without even driving. But that's what's comfortable for me. But I don't want to buy another vehicle. I'd rather wait till I need to get a new one. Now, there are other actions that you can take that are more powerful, that leverage further action by other people. So it's not just you doing something, but it's more people doing things. One is to educate other people. Take people out into nature, just like my friend took me into the Adirondacks Mountains, and that changed my life. You can buy from and invest in local companies and companies that are being sustainable and that are upcycling. You can get your neighbors or community to work together to become more sustainable. You can advocate for politicians and government policies that promote sustainability and upcycling. And once we have our sustainability minor going at Cal State Fullerton, we would be happy to work with local companies and local communities on sustainability projects. I want to end by sharing a few lines from a poem by Drew Dellinger called Hieroglyphic Stairway, which sums up why I became involved in sustainability and green chemistry. It's 3:23 in the morning, and I am awake because my great-great-grandchildren won't let me sleep. My great-great-grandchildren ask me in dreams, what did you do while the planet was plundered? What did you do when the earth was unraveling? Surely you did something when the seasons started failing, as the mammals, reptiles, birds were all dying. What did you do once you knew? Now, this poem speaks to me because although we will all be affected by our unsustainable ways, our grandchildren and our great-great-grandchildren are really the ones who are going to bear the burden of our unsustainable ways. However, we do have the power to change this situation if we so desire. Thank you. To convince institutions to become more sustainable, I think that the solutions have to be solutions that are comfortable for those institutions. Just like for any individual, it has to be comfortable for that individual. And some solutions are expensive, and the return does take a long time. Other solutions are cheaper. Like today, you can get solar panels put on your home, where essentially you're leasing the solar panels and you're not buying them. And a company will install them for you for free, and then you're going to pay a bill that's actually smaller than your current electrical bill. So you save money right from the beginning instead of having to buy the solar panels. So it's just a question of finding a solution that's workable for everybody. We've done that at Cal State Fullerton, where we didn't buy the solar panels, but we have solar panels now. So I wanted him to sign up for the president's climate commitment to reduce our carbon footprint eventually to zero. And it took a number of years, but eventually he did sign the commitment. Our campus is actually did a fair amount to become more sustainable, and although it's kind of ironic, but it's the state budget cuts that kind of forced us to do it. So I was in a leadership position. I was the chair of the Academic Senate at the time during the state budget cuts, and so I saw I looked at it as an opportunity to push green solutions because we didn't have a lot of money. And so I think we got more done during that period than we had done previously because of the fact that we were running low on money. Now, of course, those were all low-hanging fruit solutions that just immediately saved us money. But yes, we have definitely made progress since then. But it did take some convincing, much more than just my one email.